This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, this is The Money. I'm Richard Aidy. Today, we're talking about something big. Profits. Big profits, huge profits, massive profits. You'll hear what sort of sector you need to be in to make them. You'll hear about the most profitable company there's ever been. And we'll start with the most profitable company right now.
Just start by talking us through the numbers, because they are huge here.
Yeah, they are. And this is a transparency, unveiling the crown jewel of the kingdom, if you will. $111 billion is not bad.
Nope.
On revenues of $356 billion, so very fat margin. They had to.
These two are talking about Saudi Aramco. The company owns the facilities attacked by drone, an attack which disrupted 5% of global oil supply and sent prices soaring. Ellen Ward is the author of Saudi Inc.
Aramco is the most profitable company in the entire world. And that wasn't really a surprise that it was the most profitable company. I think the surprise was just how profitable it actually was. According to the financial data that Aramco released, the company made $111 billion in net income in 2018. And that far surpassed Apple, Google, or any other company.
I think before interest and tax and depreciation, amortization, it was $224 billion. So it's truly, these figures are massive, aren't they?
They're absolutely massive. And they mean that Aramco is most likely the most valuable company in the world as well. But there's a bit of a hitch to that, which is the fact that Aramco is owned by the Saudi Arabian government. And so Aramco may be the most profitable company in the world, but those profits, most of those profits are going to its shareholder, its sole shareholder, which is the Saudi government, or by extension, really, the Saudi monarch. So Aramco, compared to, say, Exxon or any other very large oil company, is actually paying much, much more in taxes and even in dividends to the government than Exxon is.
It's not only the biggest and most profitable company, it's a very unusual one.
Aramco is unlike any other national oil company in the world in that its finances and its money is actually kept entirely separate from the government. So if you look at, say, the Kuwait National Oil Company or the Iranian National Oil Company, those companies are essentially run by the government. So the government collects the money that they make selling oil, and then the government uses that money for whatever purposes it needs, and then it gives some of that to the oil company for, you know, the daily runnings of the business. Aramco, in contrast, acts much more like an international oil company in that Aramco sells oil, Aramco collects the revenue, and then Aramco pays taxes and dividends to the government.
Actually, to say that Aramco pays taxes and dividends to the Saudi government is understating it. It's understating it a lot.
The government takes a lot in taxes. It used to pay about an 85% tax rate. That tax rate was reduced to about 50%, but the government has made up the money that it needed by taking what they call ordinary dividends and also special dividends. So we have figures, say, for the first half of 2019 on how much the government has taken in dividends. $26.4 billion in ordinary dividends, and then $20 billion in special dividends. And the special dividends number is something that the government can decide if it wants more of and can increase.
Ellen, you were saying Aramco pays a lot of tax. What are the latest figures?
In 2018, Aramco paid $101.7 billion to the government in income taxes. That's separate from the dividends that it also pays. So it pays a massive amount in taxes and in dividends to the government. And according to what we know, this basically contributes about 63% of the Saudi government's operating budget. So oil or money from Aramco is what's keeping the Saudi government afloat.
I We'll come back to Aramco, the world's biggest company with the world's biggest profit result, a bit later. Because on the money today, that's what we're looking at. Big profits. This guy's done something really interesting.
My name's Jim Minifee, and I am a principal at Alpha Beta, a consulting firm.
Jim's an economist, and he's had a look at the most profitable sectors of the Australian economy.
The soaring iron ore price has swelled BHP's coffers, and it's showering shareholders with a record dividend. Full-year profit more than doubled to $12.2 billion, with almost half of that coming from the super-strong iron ore price.
Obviously, BHP is a very big deal. Not Aramco big, but big for us. But for Jim, that's not really the point. He's interested in something more specific and more useful. Return on equity.
The key point, I think, to bear in mind when we're talking about profit is that if an industry is very large, its profit might be large, but that doesn't mean that it's a highly profitable industry. So you need, as it were, a denominator, something on the bottom of your equation, which will then let you compare industries of different sizes. So let me give you an example.
Okay.
Banking generates a very large amount of profit, but then you've got to look at how much shareholder equity is invested into that industry.
Okay, so the Commonwealth Bank. Its profit for the year was $8.6 billion. The bank's worth around $136 billion. So the return on equity is a bit over 6%. Jim and his colleagues, this is back when he was at the Grattan Institute, measured which sectors achieved the best returns.
There are really strong returns in what the statisticians call internet publishing. So that picks up a lot of sectors like Seek, realestate.com, the sort of classified ads on the internet, the platform style industries, highly profitable currently. By our measure, supermarkets, wireless telco, fuel retail, electricity distribution, some of the airports, very profitable. And then there's a whole mixture of more regulated sectors like sports betting, health insurance, casinos, lotteries, and at least until recently, the banks have also been profitable by that measure of return on equity.
All right. To me, they seem at first blush a disparate group. What have they got in common?
Yeah, that's right. We tried to investigate what might, these different sectors have in common. And one group is what you could think of as the natural monopoly sectors. So those are sectors where firms realistically are going to have a very, very significant market share for their local market. So if you think about a port operator, electricity transmission and distribution, wired telco networks and so on.
Pipelines, airports,
and so forth.
Yeah, that's right. All right.
Now, many of those sectors are regulated. Nevertheless, in many cases, they are earning relatively high profitability.
So, natural monopolies, and we certainly have them in Australia. But not all of the most profitable sectors are natural monopolies.
The second big group is around sectors that have got significant scale economies. So, they might not be a natural monopoly, but for example, if there's a big logistics advantage to running a large supermarket network, or again, I already mentioned these internet platforms where you've got a virtuous circle or cycle, as it were, for the largest platforms because every user knows that that's the place to go if you want to connect with other users. And those sorts of industries with scale economies often do end up with some market power. The largest firms acquire some market power and they're able to price well above their costs and hence earn an attractive profit, at least for some period. And then I mentioned to you already these sectors with relatively heavy regulation, where potentially the regulation itself forms something of a barrier to entry to other firms. So the incumbent firms have got relationships with regulators or have got the scale to manage compliance with all of the regulations, then it might be difficult for entrants to compete with them. And it looks as if those sets of factors are correlated with good returns for the firms that are the incumbents in those sectors?
The most profitable firms all fall into one or more of these three categories: natural monopoly, scale economies, lots of regulation. And what they all have in common is that it's difficult for new entrants. Jim, is that unique to Australia?
Australia is unusual in that we're a relatively small economy and we're very remote. But for the most part, the same sectors that are highly concentrated in the sense that a few firms have got very significant market share and the same sectors that are profitable in Australia are also concentrated and profitable in other economies. So if you go down our list, the banks in this country, relatively profitable, at least until the last few years, and quite concentrated. Supermarkets, highly profitable and relatively concentrated. Mobile telcos, similarly. It turns out that the scale economies that are driving these results in Australia also drive them in other economies. Now, if you were to look at the entirety of the US, you will see a somewhat different picture. But the reality on the ground in an economy within the US of a similar size to Australia, so go to Texas or Florida or California, is often just not that different. Now, we do have a few standouts in terms of market concentration. So supermarkets are somewhat more concentrated, mobile telcos on the more concentrated end. In terms of profitability, however, the big distinction between Australia and elsewhere is that there are a few sectors that are really material in the US around the four big technology firms, which are all relatively profitable. Whereas in Australia, our tech sector, for the most part, only has scale and profitability in those effectively those electronic classified areas.
This is The Money on RN, the ABC Listen app, wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Richard Ady, and today we're looking at big profits. We've just been hearing about what makes for the most profitable sectors of the Australian economy, and a bit earlier about the most profitable company in the world. But as big and as rich as it is, Saudi Aramco is not regarded as the biggest or the most profitable company of all time. That was the Dutch East India Company, which operated between about 1600 and 1800, and at one point was worth almost $8 trillion US dollars in today's money. Chris Nierstras, who's at Rotterdam University, has written two books on the company.
Well, if you look on the returns on their stock, then they paid a high dividend. Not in every year in the beginning, but later on, the lowest that they paid was 12.5% a year. But that could go up to about 200% a year that they paid out in dividend. It depended a little bit on the year. So you had years where it was 12%, but if you look over a longer period, then it could go up to 40%, 50%, 60%. So if you look at the first 30 years, they in total paid out 200% in dividend, and later on even more. So the dividend level was quite high.
I've seen articles, and I'm sure you've seen them as well, Chris, that suggest it was actually the most profitable company in history.
Probably it was. I don't have much doubt that it probably was. But we also have to make a distinction between how much dividend they paid out and how profitable it was. Because they, as it was one of the first modern companies, it was the first company that actually had shares and shareholders. They also didn't really know how to make it function. So in actual fact, the dividend that they paid out didn't always reflect the money that they were making.
The company was the first to issue shares, the first to offer limited liability to its directors, and because it was the first, it was often making it up as it went along. But it was very good at running a highly extractive business.
They first went after spices because these were nutmeg, cloves, pepper, and these had a big market in Europe. So what they were after is they wanted to sell over there, get those at a good price and sell them back. And then they could do away with all the middlemen that were bringing pepper and cloves and nutmeg and mace through the Middle East. So actually through the end station of that route were of course the Venetians and Genoa that were trading those spices onwards to Northern Europe. So they wanted to get to the source of those spices, and the source of those spices was in what is present-day Indonesia. So you had cloves, nutmeg, and mace in the Moluccans, and you had pepper spread a little bit more around Asia in Sumatra, on Borneo, on Java, but also in India on the Malabar coast. So they were after those spices that were the most expensive part of world trade at that moment in time. You could virtually sell those everywhere. And that's what they started doing. So they started bringing back those spices to Europe, but they also started selling those spices in Asia to make a profit there.
The Dutch Parliament gave the company a very sweet deal indeed.
So what they did is that they said, well, we're giving you a monopoly so that you can sell whatever you want to our market. So they had a very strong position. But in return, they had to fend for themselves militarily. So they had their own armies, their own fleets. And of course, this is something that we cannot really conceive of today with present-day companies, that they would not be protected outside of territorial waters beyond the Atlantic, and that they had to fend for themselves. So there was a military component there that made that this company also had to have money ready to fight off enemies or to fight into markets, because that's also something that they did.
So it had, in effect, kind of sovereign powers. So when the company was operating in the Netherlands, it was subject to Dutch law, but outside of the Netherlands, it was in fact the kind of representative of the Netherlands. It could say, we have the state behind us and we're prepared to do whatever in order to trade.
Exactly. And they were almost a state within a state, because the state also gave up its monopoly on violence outside, of course, not in the Netherlands, but outside of the Netherlands to this company, which were merchants who could use that in the way that suited them. So, like you say, to say, we're representing them and we're going to fight you if you don't necessarily agree with us. So it was also a very violent company, which is something that you should always stress.
It was a very, very violent company.
They were actually enforcing themselves on the people that were producing these products, and that went in to various degrees. For instance, if you look at the Banda Islands, those were the only people producing those spices. So what you had to do is you had to control those islands. If you control those islands, then you could control the whole world trade in that spice. So that's actually what they did. And in the process, unfortunately, they also were very exploitative, because they killed off parts of the island. So there's probably about 20,000 people died in the process. But once they had succeeded in doing so, they controlled the market for nutmeg. Now, that's possible in the case of nutmeg and cloves, but for instance, in pepper, they also tried to do that, but it was impossible because it was too widespread. So there they used another tactic, that they said, we will offer our power, so our mainly ships and fleets and armies, to native rulers, and they can pay us by giving us a big part of their pepper, or a completely monopoly on all the pepper that they have, and we pay them a lower price than the market price. So there is a big part of enforcement there, which also partly explains why it was so profitable. Work it, make it,
do it, makes us. On The Money today, we're looking at very big profits, including those of the most profitable company in the world, Saudi Aramco. But if it's such a golden goose, why is the Saudi government prepared to let a bit of it go? Ellen Wald.
Saudi Arabia is an economy that is defined by oil. It is dependent on oil revenue. And so it needs to diversify. A one-trick economy is no good for anyone. And eventually that oil will run out. I think it will be quite a long time before that oil runs out, but it will run out, or we may discover an incredible new source of power and oil will no longer be as necessary as it is today. So the need to diversify is clear. The Saudi government needs to diversify its sources of income. People living in Saudi Arabia need to have other kinds of jobs. Not everyone can work in the oil industry. And so that need is clear. The question, though, is selling off part of Aramco really going to accomplish that goal? And so the idea that the prince has put forward, Prince Mohammed bin Salman, is that they will IPO about 5% of the company, and then that money will be transferred to an institution known as the Public Investment Fund, or PIF. And the PIF will use that money to invest in all sorts of other things, in tech companies, in companies in Saudi Arabia that will provide jobs and all sorts of things that they come up with, and that this will help to diversify the Saudi economy, bring in new sources of income, and provide employment. This is where it gets a little bit fishy, because it's unclear and is really questionable whether this public investment fund will really be able to do that.
Okay, that's down the track. How does the market feel about the public listing?
The market is definitely cautious about 5% of Aramco. First of all, Aramco has been an incredibly secretive company for many, many years. And so many people are very wary of it. They've been hesitant to share information about the state of the Saudi oil reserves. And many people feel that the Saudis have something to hide, and that's why they weren't sharing information. So they're very cautious. They think that there maybe isn't nearly as much oil as the Saudis have been saying there is. And other people just believe that oil companies are not valuable equities anymore, that we're moving away from oil as a primary transportation fuel, and that demand just isn't going to be what it has been. And so oil isn't going to be valuable. Therefore, oil equities won't be valuable. Others are very excited, because it's a very profitable company. And when Aramco had floated some bonds earlier this year, they were received very, very favorably. And so some people think this is an indication that an IPO will also be received very favorably.
So when's it going to happen?
Well, we don't know for sure. They're saying it will be either 2020 or 2021. On the other hand, back in 2016, we heard from the Crown Prince that the IPO will definitely be happening by 2018. And 2018 came and went, and there was no IPO. There is reason to believe it's more likely to happen now than back then, because Aramco needed to shape up its books, essentially. It had a lot of things on the books that weren't really going to be well regarded by analysts. So Aramco instituted a new, what they call it, a new fiscal regime with the Saudi government, which really delineated where Aramco began and ended and where the Saudi government was. So, for example, it turned out that Aramco was actually providing free energy for a lot of the Saudi government and the Saudi people. And they had to start being reimbursed for that. And they had to show that in the books. Now Aramco has had 2 years under this new fiscal regime, and its books are in much better shape. So it's much more likely that the IPO will happen in 2020 or 2021 than it was when it was first announced that it would happen in 2018.
Whenever it happens, once 5% is sold, we'll know what the company's worth.
The top estimate for the valuation of the company is $2 trillion. And that's the valuation that Prince Mohammed bin Salman has said he's looking for. It's questionable whether that's really what the value of the company should be. And the truth is that it's the banks who are handling the IPO and the markets that will determine what the value of the company should be. You don't want to value it too high, because if you value it more than people really believe it's worth, then you'll sell shares and they'll just drop on the first day of trading, and that will look bad. But if you value it too low, then you're not making as much money as you should be. So it's really a kind of a Goldilocks issue here. I've heard valuations as low as under $1 trillion. That's pretty low. A lot of the way that oil companies tend to be valued has to do with the price of oil at any given time. So it may depend a bit on what the price of oil is when the IPO actually happens. And right now, oil prices are low, but that could reverse, you know, within a year. So I would say that a valuation between 1 and 1.5 trillion is probably more realistic than 2 trillion, but I wouldn't be surprised if it's between 1.5 and 2 trillion.
Ultimately, the age of oil will be over. So if Aramco doesn't diversify successfully, it will die. The Dutch East India Company lasted for two centuries. Its end came partly because of the expense of continually fighting wars to keep control of its spices, and partly because of poor financial management.
They paid too high dividends, which meant that they actually didn't pay mind to all the money that was coming in. They just halfway through the year said, oh, we're going to pay out this dividend, which meant that they paid out too much dividend and they were running a loss in Europe, and that made that they were running into debt. And this was not a problem at first. First, they just financed that by short loans, because then they said, we'll pay it off later. But during the 18th century, they couldn't pay those short loans off anymore. And they went into long-term debt. And then what you get is, of course, you get a cash flow moment in the moment that you run into trouble. And the trouble they ran into is mainly war with England, because then trade stopped. And then the people who had those long-term loans started asking their money back, and they couldn't pay because they were not making any money. And at that moment in time, they went into bankruptcy. And then something happened that we can still see today happening a couple of years ago with the big banks. The state stepped in and took over the debts and continued in their stead.
I still have a question, not about the Dutch East India Company, about Australia, because we're not having any wage growth now. Is that because the money's going into the profits of those most profitable sectors? Jim Minifee.
Wage growth has been slow since, depending on when you count, around 2011, 2012 in Australia. And over the time since then, there has not been much change in profitability, although aggregate profits have risen somewhat, but that's because of the huge increase in mining capital in particular in this country. So the big picture about wage growth does not appear to be driven by a reallocation, if you like, of national income towards profit. Instead, what seems to be driving low wage growth is really two factors. So the first is that the economy has been operating somewhat below potential, and that means that firms haven't had to bid up wages in order to attract workers. And you see that slackness in the economy, particularly among in the labour market outcomes for young people. So there's good evidence that the economy is operating somewhat below its potential. And the second big factor, not entirely unrelated, is that firms haven't been investing that much. And as a result, labour productivity is not as strongly growing as it could be. And the combination of relatively weak demand for labour and relatively low labour productivity driven by this weak investment has meant that wage growth has been slower than it was previously.
Thanks to Jim Minifee, principal at Alpha Beta, Chris Nierstrass from Rotterdam University, and Ellen Wald, author of Saudi Inc., The Arabian Kingdom's Pursuit of Profit and Power. The Money is produced by Belinda Sommer. Our sound engineer is Andrei Shabanov. I'm Richard Ady.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.